This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. There have been many opportunities this week to reflect on the Iraq War, a report card for the troop surge, probing questions in Congress, an expected announcement tonight from the president of a modest troop withdrawal. As far as the American public goes, almost every poll reflects the same sentiment. Most disapprove of the war. Demonstrations are planned in Washington this weekend, but anti-war activism these days doesn't really mirror those polls. What activism there is tends to be fragmented and diffuse. Activists may mourn the lack of flower children that sprouted during the Vietnam-era protests, but as the culture shifts, those days also seem old-fashioned and dated, especially for a new war with no draft. We're talking about the anti-war movement today, its triumphs and its flaws. Later in the hour, a modest proposal. Rather than a flag-burning amendment, how about a flag-singing amendment? We'll hear one woman's cry to protect the national anthem and our ears from painful singing and botched lyrics. But first, if you're anti-war and part of the movement, why? If you're anti-war and think the movement doesn't really reflect you enough, why is that? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Todd Gitlin is with us now. He's a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University, and he was head of SDS, that's Students for a Democratic Society, in the 60s. SDS was sustained in large part by protests against the Vietnam War, and Todd Gitlin has a new book out now called The Bulldozer and the Big Tent, and he's joining us from the Radio Foundation in New York. Welcome, Todd Gitlin.
Thank you.
Now, first, Iraq, of course, is not Vietnam, but the two are often invoked in the same breath. Give us some historical perspective here.
Well, there's a lot of laziness about invoking historical analogies. The Vietnam War has a very lengthy history. It of course, is the culmination of the French attempt to hold on to its colony in Southeast Asia. And before that, Vietnam was at war with the Chinese for a millennium. By the time the Vietnam War became essentially an American war in the early 1960s, it was seen by most Americans and certainly by our whole political leadership class as a decisive test in the Cold War. If the U.S. would stop some sort of indistinct insurgency that was generally grouped as communism, if we could stop it in Vietnam, then we could stop it everywhere. And by the same token, if we quote-unquote lost Vietnam, we would lose it everywhere. The reigning metaphor of the time was dominoes. One domino would fall, and then all the dominoes would fall. Mm-hmm. The Iraq War is also, in a way, a remnant, several generations removed, of a colonial situation, the remnants of British colonialism. But it actually has more to do, I think, with the fact that, first of all, unlike Vietnam, it's sitting on an enormous pile of oil in the center of the oil center of the world. And furthermore, that it became an opportunity for the political group in charge in the U.S. To prove that it knew how to fight something that it called a war on terror. Mm. It had, thanks to the disasters of September 11th, the administration had an enormous wave of support, and in that way was like the Vietnam War, which initially had 80+% approval. Mm-hmm. But the public approval in the two cases actually declined at pretty much the same pace. Hmm. But many things are different, not the least of which is the fact that the Vietnam War was largely a war pursued by democratic administrations. And this is, as we all know, a war of the Republican Party with the occasional collaboration of maybe half of the Democratic Party.
How quickly did the opposition to the Vietnam War really come together and coalesce and be as effective as we see it to be from this vantage point in history now?
Well, it actually took years to materialize, and One of the mythologies I think that persists about the Vietnam War, the movement against it, is that what ignited it was the draft. But in fact, as the movement was growing in 1965-6, which were the decisive years of the escalation by the Johnson administration, as the movement was growing, college students were actually exempt from the draft. And in fact, you were more likely to be drafted if you were a troublemaker against the war than if you just, you know, kept your nose to the grindstone. So gradually, as the number of troops in Vietnam rose, so did the number of demonstrators, and so did the militancy and the radicalism of the demonstrations. And by the late 1960s, there were demonstrations routinely, at least twice a year, numbering in the hundreds of thousands of people. So we're talking about a movement that, just to give you an idea, I was actually one of the organizers of the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, which took place April 17th, 1965. We had 25,000 people in Washington, and we thought that was gigantic. I mean, nothing like that had been seen but for civil rights demonstrations at their biggest. So numbers grew from 25,000 by 1967. You were getting into the hundreds of thousands. By the late 60s, if you looked at the scatter of national demonstrations, you were talking about aggregate numbers in the millions. But it took years to develop.
And have you seen a similar curve to the anti-war movement? It seems like... and there's a lot of press about this, that this anti-war movement is not nearly as effective as the Vietnam anti-war movement. Fact or fiction there?
Well, largely fact, although even the effectiveness of the movement against the Vietnam War, it has to be remembered, the Vietnam War was very long. And the movement did, along with changes in public opinion, which didn't necessarily derive from the movement activity, the Vietnam War did lose popularity. But the war went on from the early 60s into the early 70s. And really, it was a 10-year war. And so, yeah, the movement did what it could, and it had some leverage because it became a significant faction within the Democratic Party, which was the war party for the first half of the war. Whereas the present war is a Republican war run by a bulldozer president, thus half the metaphor of my new book, a bulldozer president impervious to debate, uneager to solicit debate, uncurious about the war. The politics of the war have been a closed shop in this case. So, of course, the anti-war movement has been, I would say, deeply ineffective, but that's not because it's scanty. It's not because it's in general misguided. It's because the political system has been closed, and I think it's naive to think otherwise. So in the run-up to the war, you remember in February of 2003, there was this gigantic demonstration in New York. There were smaller ones elsewhere, but the big one, part of an international effort, took place on near the UN building in New York. There were, on a freezing cold day, most people thought half a million people. But there was no real follow through. And I think what this demonstrates is that people who join movements are actually reasonably rational people. They want results. They observed that there was no effect that came from that demonstration, that the administration was oblivious. And then I think the activists of that movement, by and large, and there are exceptions, but by and large, I think they decided to do something that would be more effective. And that was to become activists within the political electoral system. So much of the anti-war energy, as I see it, moved into the Democratic Party, and it obviously swept up Howard Dean in its wake and converted him into an anti-war candidate. And when he fell by the wayside, most of the anti-war activists became Kerry supporters, even though they had qualms about Kerry. But a lot of their energy became Democratic Party energy. And that was even more true in 2006, where I think the so-called net roots, which are part of this movement, did have a significant effect on the makeup of Congress. And now that many of the anti-war people are disgruntled about Congress, I think they will proceed to roll up their sleeves and get even more Vigorously involved in the campaign of 08.
Todd Gitlin, hold on for just one second. Let's go to the phones. Melody in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. One thing that I've noticed, I'm in my 30s, 31 actually, and I am currently enrolled in college, and I do not notice that many of the young people are for or against the war. They just kind of act like it doesn't even affect them. I see more people my age and older who are against it than the younger. Is this something normal that you're noticing?
Todd Gitlin, what do you think?
I don't think the polls would bear that out. I think young people are actually enormously disaffected from the war and from this administration, and they may well become lifelong Democrats in revulsion against the emergency that we've all been dragged into over the last 6 or 7 years. But it is true that the rituals of protest and of opposition have changed. And again, I think it's largely a pragmatic feeling. I think there are two reasons why you don't see this sort of 60s-like campus protest. The first is that is for the practical reason that I said. I think there's a sort of general understanding that sort of thing doesn't work.
A mistrust that students have an effect on the,
yes,
the process.
I mean,
of government.
You know, people do. I mean, young people, like anybody else, really are investing their time, energy, and they're entering into this world of activity, not just because it's fun. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes it's not fun at all. It's a lot of work. They want results, and they don't think those are forthcoming. The second thing is that the movement against the Vietnam War in the 60s came on the heels of a gigantic upsurge of movements of disaffection, of hope, of even delirious hope about the possibility of a new world. So there was the civil rights movement first, which taught a lot of people how to become political organizers, how to think of themselves. And then there was the so-called counterculture, and there was rock music, which was new. And
we'll talk about all these things after a quick break. We're talking about the lack of movement in the current anti-war movement. More guests, more calls coming up. I'm Andrea Seabrook, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. With most polls showing a majority of Americans believe the war in Iraq was a mistake, you'd think the anti-war movement would be bursting at the seams. But that's not the case. Our focus this hour is on the anti-war movement. If you're against the war and part of the movement, tell us why. If you're against the war and you think the movement doesn't reflect you, let us know that too. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And we're talking to Todd Gitlin. He's professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University and author of the book The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. Now, Todd Gitlin, let me throw a few things at you quickly, and then we're going to bring in one more guest. One of these things is the Iraq War is really different, not just because of the draft, although that's a big factor, I think, especially among college students. We're talking about the disaffected feeling of college students. The fact that there is no draft, there's no sort of sacrifice being asked of these students, affects how much movement there is on college campuses. But also, the Iraq War is responding, at least the administration says that it was responding to an act of violence which actually killed thousands of Americans on American soil. It's a very different thing to react to that than a sort of, the abstraction of the domino theory, don't you think?
Yeah, I think early on, obviously, the administration capitalized on the panic and upset of the September 11th attacks. But I think that's worn off. I mean, the polls show that the arguments for the war were so paper thin that as to be literally incredible, and they're no longer believed. I don't think it's actually central now. I think what is closer to the truth is that if you were for leaving Vietnam You knew quite precisely, I think, if you knew anything about the history and the landscape of the time, you knew what was going to follow. You knew that there was going to be a communist government in Vietnam, that it was going to be a communist government, that it was also going to be a nationalist government. It was going to be oppressive in the way communist governments were oppressive, but it was not going to be it was not going to spread. The domino theory was fictitious. Today, I think there's some apprehension, and I, you know, to my thinking, it's legitimate apprehension. What will happen if the United States leaves Iraq?
Mm-hmm.
When you ram your fist into a hornet's nest, the hornets come out to buzz. When you take your fist out, well, all kinds of things can happen. Maybe the wrong image, but I think you know what I mean. It's more like a hornet's nest than dominoes. The Iraq will not be restored. There is no government in waiting. Part of the problem is that there is no government in waiting. Vietnam was traditionally a nation that had hardened itself in centuries of war against China and then against the Japanese and the French. Iraq is barely a nation. It's existed from 1920. Saddam was holding it together through terror and violence, and then it flew apart. What happens with Iran? What happens with al-Qaeda? There was no al-Qaeda there before. There is now, thanks to George Bush. What is that? What are the implications of that? So I think there are reasons to feel, well, yes, the U.S. ought to leave, but I'm really not so thrilled. I don't even know. I'm not even that clear about what's going to happen afterward. And therefore, maybe I should just stay out of this. I think something like that is a fairly widespread sentiment.
Let's go now to one of the leaders of an anti-war group that's been involved in the movement. Her group is one of the brighter groups in color, that is. It's called Code Pink. Medea Benjamin is with us. She's the co-founder of Code Pink, and it's a women-initiated grassroots anti-war movement. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
It's a pleasure. Do you agree with the criticism that this movement is fragmented, this movement you're part of?
Well, I would put it differently. I would say this movement is multifaceted. You have people who exercise their activism through email, like with the extremely large group MoveOn.org. You have groups that are working through their churches, through their city councils. There's over 300 cities that have passed anti-war resolutions. There are groups that are working through their labor unions. There's a very large movement called U.S. Labor Against the War. There's now even a group of environmentalists and anti-war activists doing a campaign called No War, No Warming. There are lots of different facets of this movement. I think we saw it coming together in November 2006 when there was an overwhelmingly vote to change Congress, and that was interpreted all over this country as a mandate for peace.
But let's talk about some of the protests that we've seen, especially here in Washington. A big protest scheduled for this weekend. It is being coordinated by the group ANSWER, which is Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. And that group is run largely by people who are members of the Workers' World Party, a communist Maoist organization that you're just as likely to hear them talk about, Mumia Abu-Jamal and prisoners around the country of all kinds than as you are, and freeing Palestine, for example, as you are about getting out of Iraq. So what's the message to the mainstream American who might be against the war at this point?
Well, if you come out and join us on Saturday, Andrea, I think you'll hear a very clear message. And there is this large mobilization planned for Washington, D.C. on Saturday, 12 o'clock in front of the White House. And the message will be loud and clear, and it will say the majority of Americans want to see an end to this war. Bring our troops home. So I think in large part, the media has not covered the anti-war movement in the way that we would like. For example, we have done at least 8 mobilizations that have had over 100,000 people. Sometimes people come back from those mobilizations and they don't read a word about them in their newspapers. They don't see it on their TV screens. They barely hear it on their radio stations. And they wonder, well, wow, was it worth me spending all that money going to Washington or New York when people don't hear about it? So I would say a large part of the problem of people being disillusioned is that the media is really not covering the vibrant and very large anti-war movement that has helped turn around public opinion in this country.
Let's go to the phones. Logan in Louisville. Go ahead.
Hi, glad to be here. Mm-hmm. I think the peace movement always is very good at destroying its own public relations and playing into the hands of the right, which could make it appear disloyal or anti-American. During the Cold War, communism was a legitimate concern, and some in the peace movement seem to practically laugh at that, and they talk of pacifism when a much more workable tactic, I think, would have been talking about the military-industrial complex, the tax burden of the war, the way it benefits the rich. But instead, we had a whole lot of talk of pacifism, et cetera, and a discounting of the global threat. Now, with the war on terror, I've heard people talk of worry about terrorism in contemptuous terms, almost as if it was just a right-wing conspiracy that had been thought up, and that we didn't really need this military action to protect us. So I just think the left and the peace movement really should look at itself and what it does to sabotage its own PR and play into the hands of the right.
Thanks for your call, Logan. Let's take one more call at this point. Chris in Portland, Oregon. Go ahead. Are you there, Chris? Okay. We'll get back to him later if we can.
Can I answer his comment?
Yeah, please do.
Thank you. I think that it shows how multifaceted the movement is, and that, of course, there are pacifists, and there are many people from the military who are part of this movement. In fact, Saturday's demonstration will be led by a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War. We also have a very large group called Military Families Speak Out, of people whose sons and daughters are serving in Iraq right now. And those people are on the front lines with us in this movement to say, in their case, I'm not against all wars, I'm against this war, and this war is making us less safe at home. This is increasing the likelihood that we will be the target of more terrorist attacks.
So you seem to be saying that the fact that there are a lot of disparate, I'll just call it that, groups in this movement, that it's more a movement of the left than it is an anti-war movement, actually makes the movement stronger rather than more confusing?
I'd go beyond that, Andrea, and I would say it's not really a movement of the left. We have a lot of people now coming to our activities that are Ron Paul supporters. They are saying, you know, he's the only one in the Republican Party that is speaking my feelings on the war. So there are many
not fair to say that he's your average Republican.
So there are Republicans who are now joining, and we see in the polls a lot more disaffected Republicans who are looking for a solution rather than a perpetual war and decades of involvement in Iraq. So I would say our movement is incredibly strong. The fact that we did manage to change Congress, the fact that we keep seeing in the polls the public opinion is overwhelmingly against this war. The problem for us right now, Andrea, is that Congress is not responding. And there is this tremendous disconnect between what the people are saying and what Congress is doing. On the other hand, you see the presidential candidates on the Democratic side, they're falling over each other to be the anti-war candidate because they're out there listening to people every day, and they hear this tremendous anti-war sentiment.
Let me ask you a quick last question. Code Pink's mission, in part, is to achieve peace with an emphasis on joy and humor. Tell me about the humor aspect of that.
Well, we are very serious about a war that is about life and death. In fact, many of us have been to Iraq, myself 5 times, and we have people with us whose sons and daughters have died or are serving there. So we are certainly serious about these issues. But we also want to keep people involved in the movement. And to keep them involved, we have to lift our spirits up. And we do that through song. We do that through camaraderie. We do that through joy. And we do it through humor.
And a last question for you, Medea. Keith in San Rafael. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm one of the many Americans who have changed my views on the war over the years. I'm now opposed to war involvement there. But one of the problems I have with a lot of the anti-war movements is that they are not really clearly articulating a vision as to what they would do on the ground in Iraq to bring a conclusion to this. All they talk about is leaving, and I don't think that's a solution. I don't take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Keith. Go ahead, Medea Benjamin.
Well, that's not true at all. I mean, we have people like George McGovern, who wrote a whole book about an exit strategy. We have people like Dennis Kucinich. You look on his website, you'll see a whole plan. Many of the people in the Progressive Caucus in Congress have their own plans, and now we have people like Barack Obama coming up with their plans. So there are certainly many plans, and we in the peace movement, I myself went to the Middle East a year ago to meet with legislators from Iraq to ask them about their peace plan, and they said, we have peace plans, we have reconciliation plans, but you know what the number one point on every single one of them is? There has to be a timeline for withdrawal of U.S. troops. Otherwise, there'll never be a serious effort at reconciliation. So we encourage anybody who's listening to, if you agree with us, to get involved. Go to our website, codepinkalert.org. Don't just be against war passively. We need more people to be actively involved.
Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange. She joined us from our studios today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Todd Gitlin, I wonder if you have any comment to throw in here. We still have you on the line. Todd
yes.
Gitlin is professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. What do you think of the sort of disparate nature of the anti-war movement?
Well, nothing new about that. I mean, the anti movements are not armies, and media simplify, history books simplify, but media are sprawling and messy and complicated and contradictory, and that was true in the 60s too. You know, then too, there were clergymen involved, there were pacifists, there were Maoists, there were little left-wing sects, there were right-wingers, libertarians who were against the war, there were Republicans who were against the war, there were military against the war. I mean, the whole list is pretty much the same. And then, too, also impressions of what this media really was were relayed often in a distorted way by media that were far more interested in the disruptive, the garish, the extravagant, the flag burner, the Viet Cong flag carrier, mm-hmm. the disruptor. Then they were interested in the general run of movement activity, which was largely well-behaved, largely orderly, largely, in fact, middle class. So, Medea's group has been on TV this week because they were disrupting at various points, the Petraeus-Crocker hearing. And this is all right out of the same playbook. You have to be party to a collision that's photogenic in order to be media worthy.
Well, should the playbook be the same playbook? I mean, after all, this is a different war in a different decade.
No, I think it shouldn't be the same playbook for either the movement or the media. I mean, I think the media are, to overgeneralize here, enormously dismissive and uncomprehending of events that are unscripted, that come from outside the beltway, that are, complicated, that are whose leaders are not professionals, and they don't know really what they are. So they pick up the easy things.
Well,
somebody's wearing a sandal. Somebody's got a beard. Somebody's got a Che Guevara T-shirt. I've got my story. It writes itself.
Well, let me just bring in one of those writers. Adam Riley is a staff writer at the Boston Phoenix who covers media for the paper. He covered a protest on the anniversary of the invasion in March, and he's with us from member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome, Adam Riley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I don't know how much of this conversation you've been able to hear, but I wonder if you what you think of the criticism that the media minimizes the anti-war movement.
Well, this rally that I went to on the fourth anniversary of the Iraq War back in March here on Boston Common was actually covered, I think, in a very credulous, kind way by the local media. They played up the kind of mainstream, unobjectionable aspects of the protest. And what I couldn't get over myself is what some of the callers, I think, have been mentioning, the sort of far left groups that were presenting in a bit of a tone-deaf manner. And what I kept thinking as I watched this protest was, if I were a sort of politically moderate person who maybe supported the war initially but was starting to question that initial support, how would I feel if I walked by this protest? Would it make me more likely to become part of the anti-war cause? And I think, based on what I saw, the answer was no. Can I keep on talking a little bit about what I saw at the event?
Sure. Please tell us what you saw.
Well, on one of the busy streets, Tremont Street, that runs along Boston Common, the first thing that I encountered was a group of young men and women. And they were from a variety of anarchist groups They were wearing, waving black flags and black and red flags. Mm-hmm. I would have thought that, you know, that the U.S. flag would be a better choice in this particular context. They were taunting the police who were across the street, who were, you know, assigned to just keep tabs on the protest. I didn't see much point in that. Their banner said, "We stand against imperialism, not against the Iraq war." So I found myself thinking, you know, if you drive by and you see this this public face, the protest, what are you going to make of it?
It's a good question that we'll get into after a short break. Coming up, we'll get to that question, but we'll also ask you, does the national anthem include the words, "Oh, say, can you be?" Tell us your stories of butchering the anthem. 800-989-8255. That's next. I'm Andrea Seabrook. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. We're talking about the anti-war movement, and I have a last question for each of our guests. Let me start with you, Adam Riley, staff writer at the Boston Phoenix. Having covered the anti-war movement and these protests, what would an effective anti-war movement in your eyes look like?
Well, in my eyes, an effective anti-war protest would appropriate symbols of patriotism that I think to a large extent have been conceded to conservatives, starting with the flag, for example. I was talking about that earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, use the flag. Don't incorporate statements about issues that are superfluous, like animal rights or Palestinian rights. You know, save those arguments for another context. Get rid of some of the people who are going to be considered very marginal. For example, the 9/11 conspiracy theorists who I saw at this protest I've been discussing. Todd Gitlin said earlier, you know, movements aren't armies, and that's a point well taken, but I don't think that that means that there can be no internal discipline. And I think that a little bit of that would help in this case.
And Todd Gitlin, let me ask you, how would you fix the anti-war movement, the modern anti-war movement?
Well, I agree with Adam about identifying with the symbols of national value and honor, which in fact are being traduced, violated in the Iraq War. I think Adam's observation is very interesting, and it puts me in mind of another aspect. You know, think of a movement not as as a basketball game where you got squads of strategists. Think of it more as a kind of sprawling opportunity for all kinds of actors to lay claim to the event and use it for their own purposes. So while some people want to carry the American flag and make the cause look mainstream, you've got people like the anarchists you were talking about and various hard left groups who think that there's a great opportunity here because a lot of people are going to turn out for a demonstration that they themselves could not organize.
To use
this term technically and not pejoratively, parasites. So it's an opportunity for them to come around and use this and berate their pet enemies and to have media pay attention to them. And this is dangerous. I think Adam is quite right that the movement, by simply taking less a fair, everybody come and show your stuff attitude, is actually unable to show a clear impression, and that ill suits it.
A story now from Scott in Huntington, West Virginia. Tell us about yourself.
Yes, I used to be involved in organizing anti-war activities here locally and attending the ones nationally. Mm-hmm. And as your one caller kind of alluded to, I just saw how the channels for that type of activity were closed and it wasn't affecting the change that I was looking for.
Mm-hmm. So you stopped?
Yes.
You stopped protesting?
I stopped demonstrating. Mm-hmm. There are other ways, I think, of protesting. I've pulled back my activism. Now it's more individual-based. I talk to people, tell them to talk out, speak out, get educated is the main thing.
Well,
talk to your representatives, the traditional channels that may not be very effective, but you still have to try them.
Thanks for your call, Scott. And I think we'll give Scott the last word there. Adam Riley spoke with us. He's a staff writer at the Boston Phoenix, and he joined us from our studios at member station WBU Bar in Boston. And Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. His most recent book was released in August. It's called The Bulldozer and the Big Tent. Thank you both for being with us, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.